Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Ann W. Smith, co-chair of the club's member-led arts forum. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and we invite you to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org for information on events and podcasts. And now it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's panel on influences of the arts, past, present, and future. Our moderator is Thomas Robert Simpson, Arts Forum member and the artistic director of the Afro Solo Theater Company, opening its 20th annual Afro Solo Arts Festival tonight, which is the co-sponsor of this program. Thomas, I'll turn the program over to you for introductions of our very distinguished panel, including Richard Mayhew, Cecile Bibbs, Peter Callender, and Karen Caraway.
Thank you very much, Ann Smith. And we are very happy to be here as part of the Commonwealth Club's discussion series. This is our fourth time here. We were excited about the first three, and we're even more excited about the one tonight. We're excited because of the title of the panel that we have, but also the people who are on the title. When we began to think about what we wanted to discuss at tonight's event, we kept going back to this being our 20th year, thinking in terms of history, past, but also the present, and where we may be going from here. So we've assembled a very distinguished group of panelists to be with you tonight. To my immediate left is the fabulous, the very well-known, the renowned visual artist, Mr. Richard Ray Mayhew. Mr. Mayhew, get a little clap. Has a distinguished history with the type of work he produces, why he produces what he does, what he's trying to say in that. Mr. Mayhew is not only a visual artist, he's a jazz singer, he is an actor. He is a professor, so we have someone who knows quite a bit about the history in terms of art and in other fields. I'm really excited to have Mr. Mayhew here because he's someone who can connect us with the Harlem Renaissance, past, present, and he has some really interesting ideas about where we're going as a future. Right next to him is Karen Seneferu. Did I do pretty good pronouncing that?
Seneferu.
Karen is what we call a conceptual artist, but she's even more than that. As we get into our discussion, she'll probably talk about a new form of work that she has developed and is working on passing that on, as well as creating work in that arena. We have Dr. Susie Bibbs, who is an opera singer, an actress. She's a filmmaker. She has done a lot of work, in particular, particularly around Mary Ellen Pleasant, her life, what she meant to the people in this area, as well as during the Civil War. She has a great knowledge about the spirituals, how they began, and how our music has developed from that. Next to Dr. Bibbs is L. Peter Callender. And L. Peter Callender is one of the top-rated actors, not only in the San Francisco Bay Area, but around the country. He performs in theaters throughout the country. I was talking to him a few minutes ago. He is the artistic director of the African American Shakespeare Company. He was telling me about the different projects that he's working on. He has a full schedule. He always has a full schedule. I'm very, very happy that he's here with us tonight. I am also very happy to say that I'm happy that each one of our panelists is here with us tonight. Thank you very, very much. We'd like to start off the discussion by having each one of the panelists think in terms of their medium, of a person, a period of time, and artwork that they felt was very influential for their particular medium. Mr. Mayhew, can you tackle that one for us?
In terms of, I need to
If you re-announce that question.
Can you think of a piece of visual arts that has historical significance that is from the past?
Well, visual arts has always been an area that our culture has neglected to a great degree. Is how many people here go to the museums, how many go to the galleries, or how much they think of painting as just being a form of decoration. So there's this kind of mythology in relationship to American culture. But European culture, the visual arts in all the cities is quite embraced. How much we now as a culture is beginning to embrace the visual arts as an important part of our sensibility and the stimulation and motivation of functioning. So how much the visual arts is playing that great part in our functioning existence, sometimes to me always felt is a problem. And how many visual artists do you know or know about them? Or how many people here go to the museums? I know New York City, the Metropolitan Museum, and has one of the largest attendance of any place in the country, more than the ballparks. But ask the questions of the people, why are they going there? It's not always in terms of going to see individual arts. It's a community association, and they enjoy the encounter of each other, and it's a meeting place, let's say, all right? Especially for youngsters to meet other women or men, right? So you have different reasons why those go to the museums. There's a certain fascination in coming out. You can ask the question about why are you here? What did you see? How do you feel about it? They're not always aware of that because our culture is not telling them the fact that that visual experience is like going to a concert. The beautiful joy of that moment of truth. And they come out with a certain sensitivity and joy in the visual experience, but not always able to digest it and evaluate it. Coming out of the concert, if you walk away out of many concerts, music, you still hear the music, even though you're not in the concert anymore. And the same thing with literature, how much one reads a lot, and it's how many people read all the books, like myself. I read the beginning of the book and I read the ending, and if I feel good about it, I go back to the middle if there's something special going on there, right? So how many, that literature plays an important part of our existence, is how many people read, and also many of the books one reads, it's involved with the a certain sensibility of the writers are very clever in how they write. They can manipulate you into understanding what they're writing about, but sometimes you miss the point. And how much was going on in music today? I'm so involved. I'm an interdisciplinary, and that's like a dirty word.
Well,
which is involving
here,
all the arts.
Here it's not a dirty word. Thank you. Karen? Can you think of a particular work that influenced you in terms of conceptual art?
What drives me as an artist at this stage in my life, I'm, first and foremost, I want to say I'm a very young artist, certainly compared to the panel that I'm, distinguished panel that I'm sitting here with, and I'm feeling very honored to do so. But before I actually say that, I want to acknowledge the ancestors, and in doing so, ask Mr. Mayhew, may I speak before I begin?
Yeah.
So I'm asking your permission, may I speak?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hey, Karen. Karen, and for all the other speakers.
I'm fascinated by what she does.
Be sure that we speak into the mics,
yes,
for recording,
yes,
and say your name before you speak.
All right. Hello, everyone. My name is Karen Seneferu. The artwork that's really guiding my vision and my direction is the Nkisi. And the Nkisi is out of the Congo Basin. And the Nkisi is a wooden sculptural piece or a power force that has nails all around it. And at the center of the piece is a box with a mirror in it, which has hidden properties that only the artist who created it or the individual for whom it was created for knows what's inside of it. That work is a driving force for me. I'm attempting with my work to dialogue with that form, and that's the work that is very essential to my creativity.
Thank you. Cecile?
Hi, I'm honored to be here. Thank you so much. I'm Cecile Bibbs, and as a singer and classical area, I've always loved the concert spiritual. I mean, I do so many different types of music, but that resonates with me. You know, those are the songs of a people, the songs of slavery, but the songs of those generations that came after. So much of the music that we hear, you know, has borrowed the melodies or picked up the feeling of the spiritual. It is a music that was designed to reflect the culture of Africa, and it is that music that's designed not for the individual but for the group, for the healing and the upliftment and the information sharing of a group of people. It says a lot in terms of being songs of a people. So it has inspired me since I was a child. When I first began to tour, I toured with the legend singers of Kenneth Brown Billups, and I was the littlest legend singer. But you know, there's so many, if we talk of artists in that field, of course, there's so many arrangers, Nathaniel Dett, Halk Johnson, but they stand on the shoulders of some people whose names have not been called. Mm-hmm. So I want to take a minute and just call out those names, those two people, who are now capturing a lot of my attention in the area of the spiritual, and those are the Hires sisters. They were born in Sacramento. They grew up and studied in San Francisco. They were the first African-American concert singers to become famous across the land. But more importantly than that, they were the first to come out with musicals based on the African-American experience from slavery to freedom. And guess what music they chose to bring to their mainstream audiences after they'd become famous? The spiritual. And their pieces tell you something about them and what they did. Out of Bondage was the name of one. Underground Railroad was the name of another. And I'll tell you more about them later, but what I want to say here is they stopped promising amazing operatic careers to take those works and address the problems of imaging of African Americans in this country. And I began not only to admire it, but to understand why they chose more than not just opera, but the spiritual as a dominant music in their musicals that they toured. And the reason that they did that was because of the healing property of the spiritual, the ability that all music has, but that music particularly has to absorb us and to lift our mood and to bring us out of our present situations. So that's what's inspiring me at this time.
Amen. Good evening, everybody. My name is L. Peter Callender, and I too am humbled to be part of this esteemed panel. Thank you all very, very much. Thank you for the invitation. My background is, of course, theater, the classic theater. I am a graduate of the Juilliard School in New York, Performing Arts High School, the FAME High School. Studied in London, in Japan. My passion is language. Certainly the language of the theater, but I'm a Shakespearean actor by trade and by training. The things that influenced me most as an artist is I was born in the West Indies, and when I went to high school, I had teachers who told me that, yes, you are good at what you do, you're talented, but you will not be able to do the types of theater that you want to do, because you have certainly the dialect and certainly the rhythm of your speech. And I learned very, very early that the type of theater that I wanted to do, which is the classics, certainly I've done 29 Shakespeare plays, I needed to crispen the language, tighten it, make it more powerful, make my vocal qualities a lot better. When I saw James Earl Jones in Master Harold and the Boys on Broadway, it blew me away, his language, his power of language. When I saw Leontine Price sing at the Symphony Hall in New York when I was in high school, I cried just because of the power of language and how they use language and how they use their voice. So these are the influences in my life that have carried me throughout, and that's what I teach to the youngsters as I work with them now. As artistic director of the African American Shakespeare Company, it's important to me to get these young students who are coming out of the conservatories, get them in the theater, get their language right, get the power of their speech where they can go out and do what they want to do. But they have to have a start. I'm an associate artist at California Shakespeare Theater. I've been there now for 19 years. My earlier years at Cal Shakes, I would take my curtain call and there'll be two or three of me, the people that look like me in the audience. And that saddened me a great deal. It's changed a lot since then. So I want the actors that come out of these conservatories who come through our theater to get that training, to be able to lead a cast, to strengthen their voice, strengthen their abilities on stage, and then go forth and do the things that they are trained to do in other aspects of theater.
Thank you very, very much. For each one of you, as you grew and developed as an artist in your own medium, can you think of a work that you produced, whether it be visual, whether it's singing, whether it's a production, that you felt was influenced by someone from the past? I see you shaking your head. Cecile, would you like to go first?
Oh, sure. Okay, so here I have to call the name of Mary Ellen Pleasant. And so many people think I get mixed up as to who I am and who she is because I've played her at Research Trip for so many years, but I don't. I have to thank Afro Solo because one of the first times that I did the work that I'm going to cite right now, I had been doing research on Mary Ellen Pleasant since 1991. And several people, the humanities, had asked me to do Chautauqua, which is a dramatic form in which you are the art, you in costume enact that person, and then you answer questions with the audience as that person, and then you come out of costume, like Superman in a phone booth, you know. You come out of that costume and you answer questions of the audience about that character and your research. And then Thomas asked me to do a musical. Now, Mary Pleasant was the mother of civil rights in California. She's remembered officially as that in a memorial at Bush and Octavia Streets. She lived here and was a part of the history and the development of San Francisco. And she's most and best remembered as the person whose court case went to the state Supreme Court and affected modern-day civil rights law. So she's a very important woman. But he asked me to do a musical Chautauqua. It was my honor because I knew that she was also a singer. And a lot of people don't know that. And so I was able to do a Chautauqua with a drummer, great master drummer Pope Flynn, and to tour that piece wherein I told the story as Mary Ellen Pleasant and sang not only spirituals such as Oh Freedom, and but my own songs and other songs that I brought into the period. She influenced us, and we stand on her shoulders, and I certainly do. I have never stopped doing that musical. I just repeated it at the Bayview Opera House in February.
Could you tell us her period of time?
Yes, Mary Pleasant was born in 1817 and she died in 1904. Now you'll read a lot of things, but we just had the honor of redoing her tombstone and marker thanks to the generosity of all of these people, and we corrected that.
Great. Now, in terms of the other panelists, can you think of a period, a person that influenced a piece of your work? Mr. Mayhew?
I've always questioned what contribution I'm making as a visual artist, because I involved with the self-indulged joy my whole life, right? So I'm feeling that But recently I heard that my art was being enjoyed by those in rest homes and stimulating and motivating for those in terms of some inspiration and sensitivity development. So I said, well, maybe it's making some kind of contribution in that area. How many people in this audience know my work? 4, 5. All right. But I'm saying it's how many the visual artists are seen in my being here. The fact that, oh, well, he's a visual artist. What does he do? Why does he do that? And how much the visual arts is important. I noticed photography around the wall, and which in many hotels and restaurants and so forth, photography has taken over, and because they didn't recognize the artist, and many artists were in these establishments for years, but didn't pay that much attention to them or respected what they were doing. So it's part of our culture, how much we need to the education in terms of the contribution that visual arts makes. And so this was a concern of a lot of the artists in terms of the sensitivity and the contribution they're involved with. As a performing artist, I found that there was an instant applause. As a visual artist, the applause comes much later, or maybe not at all.
In terms of your work, you use brilliant, you notice, for your landscapes and your brilliant colors. And you were a part of a group called the Sparrow Group that began in the early 60s. And how did being a part of that group influence your brilliant colors as opposed to works that are more depictive of the black experience?
Well, in the 60s, how much many visual artists were involved with using African-American images. And many of the artists, and I was involved with a group called Spiral. Most of the artists in that group became abstractionist. And it says, well, what does that have to do? Because it has to do with my painting being landscapes. They're not landscapes. They're involved with the spiritual sensitivity of the African-American culture, Native American culture. It's a spiritual reaction and internalized. So I don't look at subject matter. I evolved out of the experience of nature, which nature's involved, which Afro-American very much involved in terms of recycling, regrowth, and redeveloping. There's a gallery here called Evolve, which has to do with how much Afro-Americans have evolved to another state of creative sensitivity. And the uniqueness of that kind is making a very powerful impact on American society, or has been for many years. It's become more prevalent right now. So I feel that my paintings are involved with the internalized creative expression.
Thank you. Karen?
Well, I would say first, I agree with that. When I see your work, I feel my interior move. There's something about the vibration that you bring to the colors that you put on the canvas that is magical. And it shifts something in the viewer that requires the individual to reflect on the self through the work. So it's powerful work. And yes, it is.
Well, I need
more
to talk about what she's doing in terms of conceptualism. So it's supportive of what you're doing
all
about
right.
That.
Renee Stout has been very influential for me. Renee Stout is an artist out of Washington, D.C. And she did an incredible exhibition in 1988 at the Smithsonian Institution of African Art, where she created minkisis, which is plural for inkisi. And what she was doing, she was really looking at the ways in which she could take contemporary forms and reflect on this very ancient style of the inkisi. And so she created a piece called Fetish 2, where she did a cast of her own body and turned it into an inkisi. And in seeing that piece, it's an astonishing piece. And actually, the show is called Astonishment and Power. That piece shaped me. It shifted everything that I did and do. And every time that I'm creating a piece of work, I'm attempting to dialogue with that piece and dialogue with her work. So much that I did have an opportunity to correspond with her and started developing a relationship, literally dialoguing with her, and asked her if she would be my big spiritual sister, which she agreed to do. But her work is transformative, and I'm attempting to move myself along that trajectory of artists who created without establishing a name for their work. So the Nkisis, it may have been a village of people who were creating that work, but there weren't names designed on those pieces as a way of identifying the artist, but creating work that was for the community, for healing powers and purposes. And then what does it mean to take that form on the American continent, where announcing and establishing who you are as an artist is essential to the value of yourself as a person. How do I shift from that? So all of my work is about, first and foremost, community. It's about bringing the community to the piece and, on a certain level, incorporating a memorial, some way of establishing a history that needs to be recognized at that moment, and prayer in a public space, because so much of the exhibition in public has been designed, particularly for African Americans, as a place of dehumanization. So for me, the Nkisi is a important vehicle to go into those spaces of exhibition with this understanding of the way in which the black body has been devalued in public, and to shift that narrative and have us be valued in public by expressing a very private reaction to the work.
Thank you. Peter?
I think Shakespeare put it best when he said to hold the mirror up to nature. I think my influence comes from each and everybody, each and every person in this audience, the people that are outside the door, the people that we see as we walk up and down the streets, the people on trains, on BARTs, on airplanes, our family. I take my inspiration as a behavioralist. I think actors are behavioralists. I take my inspiration from human beings, the people who live and breathe. I study that as an actor. One of the greatest influences of my career thus far, and there have been many, I've been blessed to work from Broadway to the Bay and some films and things, but I had the pleasure of portraying Paul Laurence Dunbar at Arena Stage Theater in 1999. And I remember after one, Paul Laurence Dunbar, yes, I need to explain who this man was? Okay. He wrote incredible pieces of work, from Sympathy, which is I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, to When Melindy Sings, to We Wear the Mask, great pieces of work, body of work. He was the only African-American ever invited before this period to the inauguration of a president, McKinley. He was actually invited to speak at the inauguration of President McKinley. But after a performance one evening, I was in my dressing room, and one of my fellow actors said, Peter, there's someone here to meet you. And I said, I was barely out of costume yet and makeup. And Paul Laurence Dunbar had a distinctive part in the middle of his head, which I actually did for the character. And this elderly lady walked up to me with her, I think it was her grandson in tow, literally holding her up. And she was kind of crooked and beautiful. And she reached out her hand to me, and she looked me right in the eye. She looked up at me because she was a little, and she said, when I was a little girl, my mother used to read me your poetry all the time. And it made me who I am today, because I teach English, I taught English, and my children are teachers, And your poetry influenced me as a little girl. Now, I could have gone in two different directions. I could have said, ma'am, I'm only an actor. But I said, and I put one my hand in hers, and I held it very carefully and very gently, and I said, thank you. Because she saw something in that performance that wasn't just an actor on stage. She was influenced by something. She was moved by something. I created, our cast, our director, our crew, created something that was lively, that was, in her mind, perfect. And that is my inspiration as an actor. I tend to work from the inside out to create images, style, vocal variations, physical variations, to bring that person onto the stage. I'll tell you another quick anecdote. I was doing a play called Blade to the Heat here in San Francisco. I played a Cuban boxer. And this Cuban boxer came from Cuba, very macho, and the first fight he fought, he lost, and he found out later that he lost to a gay boxer, and it made him crazy, the fact that he lost to a gay boxer. After one of the performances, and he actually died in the ring. He committed suicide in the ring because he was so ashamed of himself. But anyway, after one of the performances, I came out into the lobby, and there's an elderly couple waiting for me, and the gentleman stood up and said, Señor. And I said, Hola, señor, ¿cómo está? Because I had to speak some Spanish in the show. And he said, Señor, and he said something in Spanish, and I didn't understand. And he said, I said, sir, señor, no hablo español, do you speak English? And he says, you know from Cuba? And I said, no. He says, you know speak Spanish? And I said, no, I don't. He said, you're not from, and my character that I played was from the village that he was born in. So he assumed that I was from that little tiny village. And again, that to me is my inspiration. Is the individual, the people that I look at, the people that I see, the way you sit, the way you shake your head, the way you breathe, the way you wear your hat, the way you tilt your head. I take that in and I use that as my inspiration.
Great, and I take that as a great statement of how influential and informative art can be.
Indeed.
Whether it be visual, music, theater, literary. I'd like for us to switch gears a little bit, in that I'd like for us to bring us to the here and now. Next door, there's a discussion being held about the Trayvon situation. What I'd like to do is ask our panel of artists, in the here and now, if you were creating a work in your medium that spoke to that incident, what do you think it would be? Can you imagine what you would do?
Well, I'll take that because I am doing something on that. I'm going to be exhibiting in October at the
State your name for the radio.
Oh, okay. Karen Sineferu. And I'm doing I'll be exhibiting with Day of the Dead at the Oakley Museum. And I'm doing an installation. My work... Technokisi, using technology at the center of my piece instead of a mirror. And the mirror is supposed to hide the what's inside and in Kisi. I, on the other hand, am looking at ways to turn the inside out. Right? So I'm using technology as the mirror because that's so much of what is driving our society. Is technology. And so I create film for the piece. And so I'm doing a film. I looked at Facebook on the day that the verdict came down for
yes,
Trayvon Martin.
Yes, I'm in between, okay.
And what I was attempting to do was first not emotionally respond to that verdict, because I wanted to contain it as an artist. So I read the comments people were making on Facebook, and I started retrieving them from my friends, people who I'm close to, seeing what emotional responses they were having to it. And I decided that I would do a film of their faces and of their eyes, and then incorporating their text, and then also having the names of black men and women who have been killed scrolling down at the bottom of the film, like a news feed. So for me, my work is about memorial. You know, I look to Toni Morrison in terms of literature. I look to Toni Morrison as a living ancestor that's speaking to me about what I need to do as an artist. And one of her comments that she's made about the Academy is that it's important to take the artwork out of the Academy and bring it to the community. Mm-hmm. And to do it in such a way that it becomes a place of excitation. And I want to take this film, you know, of course there's going to be other elements to the installation. There's going to be a tree that I make out of mylar and that turns into figures that look like they're hanging from the tree. And so I want this film to evoke emotion from us. Mm-hmm. And my intention is to make you cry. Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, mm-hmm. that's my intention. My artwork is to make you cry. Okay. In order to heal. Okay. That's what I'm doing. That's what I'm planning.
Yeah.
Mr. Mayhew, let me ask you, if you were creating a piece about Trayvon, and mm-hmm. you said you might be working on something, mm-hmm. what would that piece be like?
Well, it had to do with what I was saying earlier, in terms of the whole thing of Afro-American culture and sensitivity, would be involved with this internalized expression and how much dealing with the sensitivity of the young man and how much one's involved with what I paint. It's involved with the strength of color. I don't know how many people have seen my work, but it's involved with color space, which is involved with the sensitivity of the phenomena of the illusion and concerns of Afro-American sensibility. So my use of color and form, which is reflecting that sensitivity, and how much doing a piece with more internal concern in relationship to what's going on with Trayvon Martin and what's going on in terms of profiling in our society, how much my painting in use of color and form would be involved with that stimulation. Going back to when I mentioned earlier about abstract, the artist that I was involved with in the 60s, which is not painting African-American figures, they were involved with abstract sculpture, in a sense, abstract form, which is reflecting the really internal spirit of the artist. And so the internal spirit of mine is color. I become a kind of a color expert in the sense of optic illusion, and how much using that as the force of expression and sensitivity concerning to what's going on in contemporary society, certainly with the Avon Martin situation. I'm really concerned of how much Trayvon Martin now, the feeling of what's going on there, would bring a greater image of what's going on with the internal area of the African-American community, where African-American youngsters are involved with shooting themselves. They're not shooting the other person, they're shooting themselves. What is the concern about that? And it's reflecting out of what's going on and how much one's aware of what's going on there, and how Trayvon Martin's situation brings to light of more consciousness of what's going on inside the city communities. And I think if it brings more sensitivity to that, and how much my work and form and color would contribute to that challenge and sensitivity, because that's the means of how to do it. If I just do painting picture of what was going on in that particular incident, it would not bring to light more of an impact than my use of the strong forms and color in my paintings.
Thank you. Cecile, you wanted to answer?
Sure. I am working on something. I'm raising funds now for a film and a concert to celebrate the Hires lives, which will be their dream, the change, and their legacy. And the spiritual has always been, we know, something that could raise us out of our present situation. The art, all art does this. You know, the vibrations that are this entire creation can be picked up by us easily as color, and it can also be picked up as sound, and it can also be picked up, you know, in the lives and the music of people. And in this case, the spiritual always was not only a healing, but it was it always spoke to civil rights. It was used in the 1850s civil rights movement, just like it was in the 1950s and 60s, rather. And in you see, you hear the same melodies, just twisted and just brought up a little bit. You know, in the 1850s, you might have heard "Oh, freedom" with that strong one. You know, "Oh, freedom," and we pick that up. We hear that strength, and that's what we feel inside. Mm-hmm. But then, when the 1960s came, it just Oh, freedom, over me. We get that sense of intensity and determination. It lifted the people so that they could face the dogs and the hoses. All right, well, the Hires, they were on their way to getting on the boat to go to Europe to become the first African-American opera singers, and they stopped. So their dream was deferred. No, it was just changed because they were brought up by Mary Ellen Pleasant and that whole group of people. So when they got to the time to get ready to get on the boat, instead it was 1876 when they withdrew the troops from the South and all hell broke loose. I hope I can say that. And you know, there were no more voting rights. All the things that were gained in Reconstruction were taken back. Land was lost. People were hung. And so the girls couldn't go. Their father wanted them to go. They couldn't go. So a concert that I have in mind will tell the story in music and narration and a griot, a modern-day spoken word hip-hop poet, who will in each part interpret what is happening then, which is just spiraled up now to be the same thing. The Hires stopped because one of the things they saw they could do, since they had these great mainstream audiences, was that there was an image problem. There was a profiling problem. And this was a profiling of all African Americans as in blackface by the minstrels. And so they were the first in the American theater to abolish blackface. They were the first to have African Americans playing leading roles, and they were the first to use a spiritual in a musical. So I'm going to celebrate that middle part, show the chaos in a multimedia attack of visuals and narration and drumming and spirituals. And in the end, we will hear some of what they came out with. Some of the legacy that they've left us that we can pick up with Trayvon through their musicals, which capture again the same things that the spiritual has always done: upliftment, political voice, a sense of choral work, and a sense of operatic presentation. So that's what their musicals ended up being.
All right, thank you.
And so we will celebrate a little of that at the end. So I'm going to do a multimedia piece and excerpt it into a documentary like the one I now have on PBS.
Wow. Thank you very much. Okay,
thank
Peter.
You. I don't ever want to go through my life being afraid of my neighbor. Going back to Paul Ernst Dunbar very, very quickly, he wrote a very short poem called Theology, which I'd like to read to you very, very quickly. He writes, "There is a heaven for every, there is a heaven forever, day by day, the upward longing of my soul doth tell me so. There is a hell, I'm quite assure, for pray, if there were not, where would my neighbors go?" inspired by, and I can never, I have a 17-year-old son who is currently at the University of Chicago, and the thought of losing my son for any reason at all is unfathomable to me. I cannot, I don't think any one of us can put ourselves where the Trayvon Martin family is right now. We can pray for them, we can say we feel, but I don't think we can unless we've experienced what they've experienced. So as an artist, as a director, as someone that I think I have some kind of influence, I'd like to create a piece. Maybe there are two things I'm thinking of. What happens when a child is lost and the world loses the influence of that child? How do we know what that child would have created, the art, the music, the spirituality? How would we have known that? So there's a piece that I'm going to entitle Theology that's based on the loss of a child and how a mother deals with that. The second is perhaps a jury. The audience, the lights come up on jury deliberations without the audience knowing who, what, where, when, and why. And how do we influence, how do we think as a people, as a society, how does just what's unfolding on stage influence us without knowing who was killed, the perpetrator, black, white, yellow, red, tall, short? It doesn't matter. How does that influence our thinking? And I know my time is running out, but these are the things that I'm mulling around in my head because of the Trayvon Martin.
Okay, great. We have some wonderful questions from the audience. One of them is a simple yes or no, and it's directed to you, Cecile. Are you familiar with Queen C. Anderson, one of Mahalia's voice teachers?
No.
So maybe the person who brought this up can speak with you afterwards.
Well, of course, and I did, as a child, sing behind Mahalia Jackson. That was a great honor.
Great. Another question is, dear panelists, you are wonderful. Thank you. Do you think that your being of African-American origins have been influential on your making art, or your being an art maker? If you were born Caucasian, do you think you would have pursued the same field?
What, you mean African-American art?
My guess is it's of course speculative. Is, do you think you'd be an artist?
Yeah, I understand.
And these need to be really short.
Sure. Okay. My first canvas was my body, and I still use my body as a canvas. My experience is navigated by my body and how I navigate the world in it, and how the world navigates around me because of my body. So what does that mean? I am a black woman of African descent who is a woman raised by mother and father who were African Americans. And so that influences how I shape my work.
Do you think if you were white that you'd be an artist?
I can't even imagine myself thinking other than the way I have lived in this body that I love.
Okay, great. Any other burning on that? Okay, good. You are gift givers to all of us, to me, whoever the writer is. In modesty, how is it that you see yourself in self-expression as being a gift givers? Do you feel as artists you are gift givers?
As an artist, do you see yourself as being a gift giver?
I think I'm a...
Well, this is always a concern artists, how much the contribution they're making. So there's always that question of the creative sensitivity of making some contribution to the American society. African-American artists have, in literature and also performing arts, have made tremendous contribution. The visual artists now are really starting to become recognized as making that contribution. And the concern of that is on the minds of all the visual arts, especially going back to the group I was involved with, the 60s. That was their commitment in terms of the intellectual creative contribution that the artists were making to society. And they felt that African-American cultural society was the unique sensitivity which provokes and continues the motivation of a strong society, and which has always been denied. And how much now one looks at oneself as an Afro-American, you have to realize it's not that coming to their own now. They've always been there. It's not recognized the contribution they've been making yet all this time. And even though it hasn't been recognized by, let's say, the established community, but the fact that their contribution is so unique and so special, far beyond as being recognized and accepted. So as an artist, I feel that how much a contribution to this, the group that I was involved with in the 60s really predicted what's going on with the contemporary society. It was going to become completely multicultural. And in the multicultural, in multiculturalism in terms of how much this country is made up of culture from every area of the world and has not been embraced. They said, what is American culture? That's American culture. And that has never been embraced. And how African Americans have made a tremendous contribution to that area. Even though maybe they're not seeing themselves for being profiled like this, but being profiled right now brings it to the forefront of why and who they are. And what happened with Trayvon Martin is just another stamina of challenge to the society that the Afro-Americans are here, and they're only going to stay here, and they're making a contribution to our making a not only making a contribution, but this is the contribution of this American society. It's multiculturalism. The uniqueness and sensitivity of that is far beyond evaluation by the sociologists and anthropologists right now. And so how African-Americans realize that the who they are, and they've been denied who they are, but the internal recognition of who they are is now being felt and known. And I think this is something this special, unique is taking place today, especially incident like this that happened that turned, challenged the whole society, right? And let's get rid of the internal problem that's going on in the inner city. That's my very concern right now. And that has where youngsters are killing themselves. They're not shooting their brother, they're killing themselves.
Very, very briefly, sorry, Thomas. I love the phrase of gift giver. I think with me, I'm a gift give backer. Does that make sense? My mother, Elsa Callender, rest her soul, she raised me, a single mom, raising me in New York, gave me opportunities to go to museums and arts exhibits and things like that. So I grew up in the arts. I grew up given that gift. My training at the Juilliard School, as I said earlier, in Japan, I'm now able to give back some of the things that I've learned. I coach, I teach, I support young actors. I work with kids a lot. So I think I'm blessed with giving back some of the things that I've learned over the years.
I'd like to echo that just very quickly to say that I when you raised that, I thought, no, I've been given so many gifts. I want to just show the gifts also of others using those gifts.
Yes.
And that's, I think, what I am about.
Mm-hmm. And I think for myself, anytime I go into a space where I'm creating, if it's an institution like a museum or a gallery, at some point I have to bring other artists with me. I feel it's my duty to not just step into that space by myself, but to actually bring other artists along. And in doing so, the artwork isn't just about me, but the way in which the community has contributed to it.
Yes, I started a group foundation called the Living Heritage Foundation. It's because we stand on those shoulders that came before us, and because as we bring forward those, we need our heroes. And if we bring those heroes to the public, to the people, then they see I can. They see themselves in that mirror. And that brings the whole society to realize the power that is there. That is empowerment.
I just want to say one more thing, too. I wouldn't be an artist without my husband, Malik Senefru, the artist. And so I just want to give that to him.
Okay, great. Let's think in terms of the future. What is happening in your particular arena or medium right now that you think will have some influence in culture or the arts in the future?
Well, you have realized the future is now, which is part of African-American culture and Native American culture. It's not yesterday or tomorrow, it's right now. And how much you deal with now is part of the future. And how much the future is involved with the very unique continuation and more awareness of accepting multiculturalism, the strength and power of this country. And it's not being really realized and accepted. Now, how much this audience is really a multicultural power group right there, looking at the mixture of the multiculturalism in this audience. How much that's part of the people here would go away and pass it on to their inner community in terms of, you know what's really going on? It's now, not tomorrow. What happened yesterday is part of today, but tomorrow is now.
When you walk into the African American Arts and Culture Complex on Fulton Street, 762 Fulton Street, on any given day or time, there's something going on. There's an electricity in that space. As soon as you walk into that space, you look to your left and you look to your right, there's art. There's fresh, beautiful, stunning, colorful art that challenges your mind instantly as soon as you walk into that space. If you keep going straight through, there's the Burial Clay Theater, where the My Theater, the African American Shakespeare Company, is housed. We do the classics with color, simply meaning that we take Shakespeare, we take Ibsen, Chekhov, Pirandello, Oscar Wilde, George Bernard Shaw, most recently Tennessee Williams. I directed Cat on the Hot Tin Roof. And we take those plays and we say, what if we can have an African American family that's the Willie Loman family in Death of a Salesman? Who says that cannot be an African American family? And we take that and we represent that. And answering Thomas's questions, I choose plays every season that has at least one or two children in it.
Yes.
Because I want them to see themselves in the arts and to see themselves learning from the professional actors that I bring on that stage. And then to have them come up to me afterwards and says, Mr. Peter, which is, I love the way they call me Mr. Peter, that was great. I learned so much. I'm reading Much Ado About Nothing in my class now. I read a scene from Hamlet to my dad and he loved it. That brings tears to my eyes.
And the spiritual today is being used in physiology, in healing those people who have lost. They're taking the spiritual with art and having cross-cultural groups sing and draw and discuss those things. Beethoven talked about the universe being all vibration and we having a special vibration. And they're taking this understanding and studying physiology and using it in music therapy. The future is incredible for the actual application of the spiritual that we knew many, many, many years ago. And when I was in Africa, to end very quickly, when I was in Africa, my host, who was a very, very generous man, got robbed. And many people came in with guns and took things. And people were sitting around the living room the next day, and he was a king, and so he was supposed to go out into the community. And everybody was feeling down, and nobody wanted to go out into the community. And so somebody picked up a drum, and somebody sang. And then another person added a verse about what happened, and the spiritual came alive in front of me. And pretty soon they were getting up and dancing and moving, and that vibration of all that ill had dropped off. And I saw at that moment the upliftment of art.
Community and art. Yeah.
And one final comment, Karen.
Oh, okay. For me, creating a space for young artists to create a space for other artists.
Hear, hear. You've been listening to a panel at the Commonwealth Club of California in association with Afro Solo Arts Festival on influences of the arts past, present, and future. our heartfelt thanks to our wonderful panel, moderator Thomas Simpson, and panelists Richard Mayhew, Cecile Bibbs, Peter Callender, and Karen Sineferu. Thank you. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Mm-hmm.